Translation: O purest Vidura, of the lower animals, the cow, goat, buffalo, Krishna stag, hawk, Gavaya animal, deer, lamb, and camel, all have two hooves. 23rd verse text: The horse, mule, ass, gaur, sharva, bison, and wild cow all have only one hoof. Now you may hear from me about the animals who have five nails: the dog, jackal, tiger, fox, cat, camel, sajaru, lion, monkey, elephant, tortoise, alligator, gosav, etc. All have five nails in their claws. They are known as panchanakhas, or animals having five nails. 25. The heron, vulture, crane, hawk, bhas, bhalluka, peacock, swan, saras, chakravak, crow, owl, and other birds. Text 26, translation purport. The creation of the human beings, who are of one species only and who stock their eatables in the belly, is the ninth in the rotation. In the human race, the mode of passion is very prominent. Humans are always busy in the midst of miserable life, but they think themselves happy in all respects. Purport. The human being is more passionate than the animals, and thus the sex life of the human beings is more irregular. The animals have their due time for sexual intercourse, but the human being has no regular time for such activities. The human being is endowed with a higher advanced stage of consciousness for getting relief from the existence of material miseries. But due to his ignorance, he thinks that his higher consciousness is meant for advancing in the material comforts of life. Thus, his intelligence is misused in the animal propensities, eating, sleeping, defending, and mating, instead of spiritual realization. By advancing in material comforts, the human being puts himself into a more miserable condition. But illusioned by the material energy, he always thinks himself happy, even while in the midst of misery. Such misery of human life is distinct from the natural, comfortable life enjoyed even by the animals. Om Jnanati Nirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuri Nirutam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Deshatarine Vanchatalpatarupyascha Krupasindhu Vyayevacha Patitanam Pavivyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna. Today morning we are discussing about the Srimad Bhagavatam, where the creation is, its unfolding is described till the point of the development of human beings. So, in the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto also, a similar narrative is given. And there, a very interesting point is made. Sushtva Puranani Vidayaya Ajayatma Shaktya. It is said that the Supreme Lord Ajaya, he created all the living beings, but he was not satisfied. But when he created the human beings, then he felt satisfied after the creation of human beings. So why is that? Brahmavalokam adhishnyam. Because in the human form, Brahmavalok, that one has a capacity, avalok is to see, Brahma is spiritual reality. So in the human form, one has the capacity for spiritual perception. And that is what makes the human form special. So, the Lord felt that now, with the human form being manifested, the purpose of creation will be fulfilled. So, I'll talk about this class in three parts. First is, I'll talk from the scientific perspective, what is the difference between humans and animals, or what is thought of as a difference. Then I'll talk from the perspective of the Abrahamic religions. And then I will talk from the Vedic perspective, specifically, what is the difference? And how that difference can make a big difference in our lives when we understand it.
So now, in the word science itself came about in the 18th century. We consider Newton as a great scientist, but Newton never called himself a scientist. He was a natural philosopher. That's what he called himself. So, in whether Eastern thought or Western thought, it was understood that there is some significant difference between humans and animals. And that humans are more intelligent, that is one aspect of it. But what exactly was the basis or reason for this difference, that was never exactly pointed out. Yes, there is the concept of the soul, and we will discuss what that concept was in the Abrahamic religions later. But when Darwin proposed his theory of evolution, one of the results of that was, he said, we humans have got a very big ego. We think that we are special, that we are the center of the universe. And this view was actually a reaction to the Christian view. So to actually understand what was shaken by the Darwinian evolution, we will have to understand the Judeo-Christian view of the world. The idea is that Jesus is the savior and he has come to save the earth. In fact, there are many Christians who consider the prospect of any extraterrestrial life, life on any other planets, as a threat to their world. Because, you know, Jesus is the savior and Jesus has come on earth. So if there are other planets where there are people, who is going to save them? And there is no savior apart from Jesus. Jesus is the only way. So, on Christian missionary said that, you know, a Christian scholar said that actually the discovery of extraterrestrial life would be devastating for the Christian worldview. Because it is Jesus taught principles which are timeless, but subsequent Christians have reduced him to the role of the only savior, and that is the problem. But anyway, in the Jesus, if you look at his teachings in the Bible, the Old Testament is primarily an account of God's people. The Jews, how they were delivered when they from Egypt, and how they eventually came to Jerusalem. So there is not much direct knowledge about God. And Bible, New Testament, that is Jesus' parables. And there he gives moral stories and parables he gives. But here again, there is no direct knowledge about God. So both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, there is not much philosophy per se. There are moral instructions and there are travel narratives where God keeps intervening. So, now we know in Jerusalem, in the Middle East, Christianity evolved. And at that time, Greece was a center of learning. So, when some of the Christian evangelicals, Paul and others, went to Greece, they found that Greek people have much more philosophy than what we have got. So, they tried to, St. Augustine was a primary person who tried to integrate Christian theology with Greek philosophy. And later on, in the 11th century, later on, 11th, 12th, 13th, medieval ages, another pioneering philosopher was Thomas Aquinas, who tried to integrate Greek Christian theology in with Greek philosophy. But Augustine primarily studied Socrates and Plato, whereas Aquinas studied Aristotle. And basically, what is called as Christian philosophy today is descended from these two main sources. Aquinas and Aristotle, or Augustine and Plato. Now, either way, Augustine was very influential in his early times, but after Aquinas came and postulated, he was a very powerful logician in his own way. So, his ideas gained a lot of prominence. Now, one of the ideas that came from him, so in the Bible, if we see, there is an understanding that the last creation that God made was man. Right? With God was satisfied with the creation. He said, he looked at the creation and he said it is good. So, Thomas Aquinas, he came up with the idea that souls are present only in human beings. In fact, not only that, there are some Christian theologians, he had the idea that souls are only in men. Women also don't have souls. So, but the idea was souls are restricted to humans. Now then the question comes up, what about other living beings who have life? So, obviously the life is consciousness. Where does it come from? So then Aquinas proposed that there are three kinds of souls. Mm-hmm. So So there are vegetative souls, there are sentient souls, and then there are intelligent souls. I won't go into technicalities of classification. But he says, plants have mutable souls. And animals have some other kind of souls, which experience emotions. But only humans have the soul which can be illumined with the light of God's knowledge. So that rough understanding was there, that spiritual knowledge, knowledge about God, can be understood only by humans. But what he did was, he classified in such a way that humans stood separate from the rest of the universe, rest of the world. And their idea is that the souls of all except humans are temporary. So, when an animal dies, its soul also dies. Only human souls have the potential to be eternal. So, corresponding with this is also the idea that the earth is at the center of the universe. So, the earth is the center of the universe and humans are the center of all the species. So, the Copernican revolution, as it is called in science, when Copernicus says that the world doesn't go around the earth, the universe doesn't go around the earth, it goes around the sun. That itself was a great challenge to Christian philosophy. But now, none of this is directly in the Bible. It was what was adopted by Christians from the pre-existing Greek philosophy. So, when Darwin proposed the theory of evolution, one of the most devastating consequences for Christianity was that if humans have evolved from monkeys upwards, then there is no scope for a special soul in humans. So, what happens is, by that, subsequent to Darwin, there are other, now Darwin proposed the theory of evolution. Now what is prevalent in academia is called as the evolutionary synthesis. So he and other theorists have all proposed various things together. So the result of the evolutionary synthesis was that all of creation became despiritualized. So the Christian worldview had already despiritualized nature and despiritualized the non-human species. Because the idea is there is no soul in them. And what Darwin said is that actually if humans have evolved from monkeys, then humans also don't have any soul. So the whole of creation became despiritualized. And he said it is only our human ego which makes us think that we are special. We are just more sophisticated animals. And we should have the humility to admit that. So now, that's how he tried to market his idea. So now, because there is such a big barrier in the Christian worldview between the non-humans and the humans. So some Christians who have accepted the theory of evolution, they say that by evolution, animals came. And at the time of when animals were going to evolve to human beings, God intervened and he put a soul there. So it seems quite preposterous. God can do anything, but you know, you can't make God do things to accommodate the needs which have come from some theory. So, the problem is that there was already a despiritualization of most of creation, and that had already happened because of Christianity. And further, when Darwin came along, the whole of creation, including humans, became despiritualized. Now, definitely, there is a difference between humans and animals. And even scientists know that. But they say that difference is simply biological. Just our brains are more developed. And so what exactly is the difference? Now, within science, there are hard sciences and there are soft sciences. Physics, chemistry, biology, there are hard sciences. Psychology, sociology, economics. They are considered soft sciences. Because they can not operate on the same hard evidence. That the hard sciences operate on. Now in psychology, there have been many different theories, and psychologists say that there are primarily, if you want to define what is the difference between humans and animals. Now many psychologists accept evolution, but they say by evolution, this sort of difference has come about between humans and animals. So the difference that they say is primarily four things. They say one is self-awareness. Self-awareness means we can look at, they're not talking about self in terms of Atma. But self-awareness means, say if I am sitting here, I can visualize if I were somewhere up over there, if I was in the audience and I am looking at myself, I can visualize how will I look? Is my tilak straight or twisted? You know, how do I look? How do I appear? So we can, as a mental exercise, put ourselves out of our body and look at ourselves. That means we can look at our own thoughts. This self-awareness is not present in animals. This capacity, they survive and they do whatever is required for protecting themselves. But they don't have this capacity for self-awareness. To be aware of one's own thoughts, to be aware of one's desires and to look at them from a distant perspective. So, after self-awareness, the next thing that can come is self-evaluation. That is conscience. That means, okay, this is how I am. Am I doing the right thing? The concept of right and wrong is not there in animals. They act largely by instincts. So, it is not that if a cat sees a rat, the cat will think, today is Ekadashi. I have to fast. So, it does not have that capacity to evaluate in terms of right or wrong. Its right or wrong is determined largely by the survival instinct. Even when, say, dogs are very faithful to their masters, and dogs may lay down their life for their masters. But that faithfulness is not a consciously chosen quality. It is a genetic instinct that is there in them. So self-observation, then self-evaluation. Then, the third capacity that the psychologists say that we have is self-visualization. Self-visualization means, I can visualize how I should be. So for example, if I get angry, then I can think at myself and think that I should not become angry. So self-observation is, I'm getting unnecessarily angry. Self-evaluation is, I need not be so short-tempered. Self-visualization is observing, imagining, oh, I can be a very calm person. Somebody shouts at me, I can respond calmly. That's self-visualization. And the last is self-correction. That I have the willpower by which I can change myself. So, these are all connected to the self. Now, the self is not, the concept of self is not Atma. It's just who I am, as many materials are thought about. So, observing ourselves, evaluating ourselves, envisioning a better me, and becoming a better me. These are the faculties which are there in human beings, which are not there in animals. This is what psychologists also know. And the whole idea of psychology, or at least of some branches of psychology, is that people can become better people because we have this capacity for improving ourselves. So now, what is it? Now coming to our Vedic worldview. Now in principle, we know that the Mahabharata says, and Upanishad also says that, Ahara Nidra Bhayamaitanam Cha Samanyam Etat Pashu Bhinnaranam Dharmo hi tesham adhiko visheshu dharme nahina pashubhi samana. That in eating, sleeping, mating, defending, people are, humans and non-humans are all identical. But what differentiates humans from animals is dharma. So now, here the word dharma is in Sanskrit notoriously multivalent. Multivalent means it has many, many meanings. And here, when we say use the word dharma, it does not simply mean religious activity. Now that way, parrots can also be trained to chant Krishna's names. But the parrot is not exactly practicing dharma. So the word dharma, when it said use over dharmo hi tesham adhiko visheshu, it essentially refers to the metaphysical pursuit of the meaning of life. Dharma, yes, there are certain activities which we do in dharma. So, in different religions, there might be different rituals that are done. This may be considered as religious. But there is a purpose. The purpose is to understand the higher dimension of life. So, what differentiates humans from animals is not just the capacity to do some religious rituals. It is the capacity to inquire about the ultimate purpose of life and the capacity to pursue that ultimate purpose. So, dharmo hi tesham adhikoshu. This is what specially differentiates. Now again, this is something which scientists won't agree. They say there are so many differences between humans and animals. You know, humans have languages, humans have developed languages, humans have civilizations, we have developed science and technology, we have art, we have literature. There's so many differences. So why should you say that religious activities alone differentiate humans from animals? So, if we equate dharma with religion, then we will run into this problem. So again, we have to understand that when the Mahabharata is differentiating between dharma and ahar, nidra, bhaya, maitri, this differentiation is not just in terms of forms. It is in terms of purposes. Humans may have developed television, humans may have developed internet, animals may not have internet. But if we look in terms of ultimate purposes, what is internet used for? It is used for eating, sleeping, mating, defending. And one of the biggest uses of internet is for pornography. If we look at television, what do people watch on television? Soap opera, which is what? Mating. So eating, sleeping, mating, defending, essentially in terms of ultimate purposes, that is what all human beings do. Science and technology has been enormously developed, but now, if we look at the fuels, the primary fuels for the development of science and technology, there are two: the consumer industry and the defense industry. Now, at the time of war, the First World War and especially Second World War, defense expenditure boosted up, defense research boosted up, and in general, the scientific science is used for creating products that will facilitate people's eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So science in form may be substantially different from what animals do. But in purpose, science is used primarily for eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Now there are some scientists who are also thinkers. They want to understand what is the answers to the ultimate questions. And if science is used to seek answers to ultimate questions, then that searching for ultimate questions is what dharma is. So then that scientific search, it has also taken many scientists towards spirituality, towards God.
I think it was Pascal.
I think Pascal said a little of science takes man away from God, but immersion in science brings one back to God. So the point is, the differentiation between animals and humans, when we look at what the scriptures talk about, it is not just in terms of forms of activities, it is in terms of purposes. So, now, this is with respect to the principle of dharma. But now if we look at the body, whether it is humans or whether it is animals, we all have a gross body, we have a subtle body. And the gross bodies and subtle bodies of humans and animals are made of the same components: earth, water, fire, air, ether, intelligence, mind, intelligence and ego. So then where is the difference between humans and subhumans? If the body is made of the same ingredients, then what is it that makes the human body special? Actually, it is not something about the human body that makes the human species special. It is that the soul itself has an innate spiritual capacity. And the human body offers the least covering to the spiritual capacity of the soul. Dhumena avriyate vahanir yatha darsho malinacha yatholvena avrato garbha sathavte nedam amritam. In the Bhagavad Gita in 3.38, Krishna describes how lust covers all living beings. And three metaphors are given over there. So, dhumena avriyate vahanir, just as fire is covered by smoke, just as a mirror is covered by dust, or just as embryo is covered by the womb. Similarly, lust covers all living beings. So, the Acharya describes, which Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes in his Vidvat Ranjan, that the covering of fire by smoke is thin and it can be removed. So that refers to the human species. The covering of a mirror with dust, that is often, it can be so thick that you may not even know that there is a mirror behind it. You just see dust over there. So that cleaning will take more time. That is a thicker covering. That refers to the animal species. And the child is in the womb, the child just cannot come out till the time the pregnancy leads to delivery. So like that refers to the covering when it is compared to a child, embryo covered by womb, that refers to the plant species, where the covering is so much that till the soul evolves, we can't even very vividly perceive consciousness in the plants. So the point of this, quoting this example, this verse is that in human form, the covering on the soul is the least. And because of that, there is the capacity for spiritual perception. Now correspondingly, of course, it is true that the human brain is more developed than the animal brain. In terms of just the size, but also of the networking within, the neuronal connections are much, much more than the monkeys. But that would, that, those neuronal connections, the sophistication of the brain, that will lead primarily to greater information processing capacity. That itself will not change the purpose, the capacity for inquiry about ultimate purpose of life. That does not come just because our brain has greater information processing capacity. That is that capacity for inquiry about the ultimate purpose of life, that is an entirely different faculty. And that comes because the soul is less covered in the human form as compared to the non-human forms. So that means, when we talk about covering, it's not literally a physical covering. It's not like, say, I put a scarf around my head. It is a covering in terms of the capacity for perception. So this, the soul in animal species cannot think much beyond immediate needs. Now, somebody may say, no, animals also think of long term. Now, for example, say, some animals, bees, store honey in beehives. Or some animals, they may make plans for winter by burrowing underneath and going. So they also think long term. But, yes, they do. But in animals, this is largely instinct. It is not a matter of conscious planning and intentional decision making from them. It is just that they are biologically triggered to do that. So, the same God who has created all living beings, that God has given different living beings different capacities for survival. So the animals, when they seem to exhibit intelligence, that intelligence is, first of all, it is not about the ultimate purpose of life. And even if it seems to be sometimes long term, that is biologically triggered. That is simply genetically triggered. In humans, we have the capacity to deliberate and decide. So, and now going back to the Christian worldview. So see, what the Vedic worldview says is, what the Gita and the Bhagavad tell us is that there is the same soul which is there in all species. Or similar nature of the soul. The soul in animals, soul in plants and soul in humans. Essentially, the soul is the same quality. What is different is the level of the covering. So the Bhagavatam worldview shows us how all of creation is spiritual, potential. Why? Because all of creation has soul within it. So now, the Bhagavatam and the Christian worldview, they agree that humans alone have the capacity for spiritual perception. But the cause is attributed differently. So what the Bhagavatam explains us to be a progression in development. In humans, the development is at such a level that we can perceive spiritual substance. Whereas in animals, the development is not enough. So what is considered as a progression in the Bhagavatam's worldview, the Christian worldview sees as a rupture. There is an irreversible rupture between man and the rest of the creation. So they say that the speciality of human beings for what Aquinas called as the light of reason, to learn from the light of reason, that comes because of a special kind of soul. Now this is something which is unfounded. And that's why many even Hindu thinkers who were influenced by Christian thought, you know, they rejected the idea that there is soul in animals. Or some of them, even if they accepted it, their idea was they accepted reincarnation. So there are many thinkers, you know, if you look at the survey of reincarnation, number of people accepting reincarnation is increasing. But a large number of people who accept reincarnation, they think humans reincarnate only as humans. They don't accept the reincarnation going downwards. And even among those who accept it going downwards, or the ones who accept that animals have souls, many prominent Hindu thinkers, they say that reincarnation is only progressive. It is not regress. They say souls can evolve from animals to humans, but once you come to human, you'll never go back to animals. Why? Because they are also sort of influenced by this huge distance which they perceive between humans and animals. So if science, it said that this is simply the human ego, that we think we are superior to the rest of the animals. And that's why they criticize the Christian worldview. So in one sense, in principle, the Vedic worldview agrees to that. It's not that we are above all of creation and the rest of the creation is meant for our consumption and our exploitation. No, the animals are also souls like us. And that's why there is a universality to the Vedic worldview. But the direction of the universality is different in revolutionary science and in Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam universalizes all species by spiritualizing everyone, by saying that everyone is spiritual. Whereas evolutionary science, it universalizes everything by de-spiritualizing everyone, by saying no one is spiritual, everybody is material. So, the aspiration that yes, nowadays there is what is called the animal rights movement. And they say, why should humans be considered special? Animals should also be considered special. So just a few days ago, the New Zealand government recognized that animals also are sentient beings and they also have rights. So, this is a step in the right direction. And nowadays in modern times, there is an egalitarian sentiment. You know, everybody is equal. So, that sentiment is good, but that does not require the acceptance of materialism. It does not require de-spiritualization of everything. Rather, it will come best by re-spiritualization of the whole creation. So, all life is sacred. Not just because all life is a creation of God. That is true. No, but all life is sacred because all life comes from souls just like us. So now, in this way, the egalitarian spirit which the modern postmodern times aspire for, that is actually fulfilled and in fact perfected in the Bhagavatam's worldview, that all living beings are potentially spiritual. Now, Srila Prabhupada in his purport makes an interesting point. He says that humans suffer more than animals. And he used the example say that animals have regulated times for sexual intercourse, whereas humans do it anytime. So now, why is this? Well, there's a thinker, he said that humans are the only species who eat when they are not hungry, mate when it is not the season, sleep when they are not tired, and fight when there is no reason. So, why is it that if we humans are among the really intelligent species, why is it that we seem to be unintelligent even in eating, sleeping, mating differently? This is an important reason for this. That our existence is bidimensional. Bidimensional means we are spiritual beings in material bodies. Now, in the human form, the consciousness is developed enough to want more than what the body can offer. The consciousness is developed enough so that we want more than what the body can offer. In the animal species, the consciousness is so locked into the body that the person, that the living being is just a slave of the body. It's like that, more or less like they're governed by instincts. So whatever the body's urgings come, they do that. Now we also have bodily urges, but we want more than what the body can offer. That's why I'll talk about how this manifests in material life and then how it can manifest it and actualize in spiritual life. That's why we will see that in eating, sleeping, mating, defending, we will try to improve things. A cow will eat the same grass throughout its life. Now, humans will not want to eat the same food. They want to cook food. They want to increase its taste. And they want to try out new cuisines. A bird will stay in the same nest throughout its life. Now, we want new house, better house, bigger house, flashier house. So, with respect to eating, sleeping, mating, defending, we try to improve things. Why? Because of our developed consciousness, we want more than what the body can actually offer. We want more than what the body can actually offer. But the body's capacity to offer pleasure is limited. And when we try to extract from the body more pleasure than what it can naturally give, then that attempt to seek more pleasure rebounds on us as more misery. That means animals, as they eat when they are hungry. In the jungle, there are some ferocious carnivorous animals like tigers and lions. No, if a tiger or lion has eaten its food, even if an animal of prey goes by, the tiger will not attack. Even if humans go by, the tiger is not hungry, firstly, and secondly, the tiger doesn't feel that a human is a threat to me. Tiger will not attack. Sometimes, of course, if the tigers have seen humans threatening them, then they will attack even when there is no hunger over there. But in general, animals are driven, they eat when they are hungry. We humans, because our consciousness is developed. Now, when I say consciousness is developed, what does it imply? The Atma has the capacity for Sat, Chit and Ananda. So, because of this capacity for Sat, Chit, Ananda, Ananda is an innate characteristic of the soul. The soul is by nature blissful. And the more the consciousness of the soul is developed, the more the soul seeks bliss. Now consider a grass. Its only conception of growth is just one direction, vertical. I'll become taller than others. There is no other goal in its life. The consciousness is so restricted over there. But we humans, we want to grow in various ways. And so that soul's nature of being filled with happiness, being blissful, when that soul identifies with the body, the soul tries to seek bliss at the level of the body. And because the body offers only a limited level of bliss, so the soul tries to increase that capacity. So what we do is that, as that thinker I quoted, is that we eat even when we are not hungry. Because we eat not only for food, we eat for pleasure. And that's why among the various species, you know, humans are practically the only species which gets so many digestion related problems. We overeat and then we get digestion related problems. And similarly, if we see a large variety of the sexually transmitted diseases, they come because of sex is a biological drive. Now there is pleasure in it, and along with the pleasure, that the primary function for which it is done is procreation. Sex is the mean by which nature has arranged for procreation. And during that procreation, pleasure is also there. But because we want pleasure, as souls, we need pleasure. It is our nature to be pleasure seeking. And sex is an intensely pleasure giving activity. It's momentary. For the last few minutes, it's intensely pleasure giving activity for those few moments. Madhu lavai. Prahlad Maharaj says, there is a drop of nectar. Madhu. But it is, he says, not even a drop, it is lava, it is a fraction of a drop. Is there? But because that pleasure is there, we want more and more pleasure. And so what we humans try to do is, so that we want the pleasure from sex, but the pleasure is tied with procreation. So we separate the pleasure and the procreation. So some people say, sex is natural. Now why do you artificially, unnaturally restrict the sex drive? Well, sex is natural, that is true. But then, this natural also is the result of sex, that is procreation. Now, why do we stop that artificial? No, contraception, birth control, none of these happen naturally. No, we do this artificially in various ways. So, if we really wanted to live naturally, then we should take the full natural package. Natural packages, yes, there is pleasure, but along with that pleasure, there is procreation. But we want to avoid the procreation and we want only the pleasure. And we try to devise means for that in various, using science and other things like that. So, the point which I am making is, we humans seek from the body more pleasure than what the body naturally gives. And this rebounds on us as more misery. Because the body's capacity to give pleasure is limited. There is a certain amount of food that I can eat. If I try to eat more than that, the body doesn't have the capacity to digest it. That leads to problems. Similarly, there is a certain sexual pleasure that is there that we can have as human beings. But when we want more and more of that, then that creates not only sexually transmitted diseases, that leads to so many relationship problems, that leads to so much. Many wars have been fought because of the unrestrained sexual drive. So, overall, we human beings end up more miserable than the animals. One of the most graphic ways we could understand this is that the animals live in much greater anxiety than us. Prabhupada says in Ishopanishad purport that, he is a little sarcastic there, he says that the economic needs of the animals are as important to them as are our needs to us. Now, they may not think in terms of currency, but he says economic needs, the needs for eating, sleeping, mating, depending. But he says they are fulfilled under nasty and unpleasant conditions. What does that mean? If a mosquito is biting me, essentially what is the mosquito doing? No, it is just eating. And I will come and just crush it. Imagine, or if I am not cruel, so cruel, if I don't crush it, I'll just knock it off. So imagine we are sitting down for prasad and somebody knocks off the plate away from us. You're horrified. Or somebody just knocks us around only. It is even worse. So, for the animals, there is a great insecurity in all the activities that they do. Eating, sleeping, mating, living. That's what Prabhupada says. For the animals, their basic needs are fulfilled under nasty and unfavorable conditions, unpleasant conditions. In human society, there is order by which our body needs can be fulfilled in a more orderly way. But the humans, when we seek more pleasure from the body than what it naturally gives, then, as I said, that the animals have more reason to be anxious. Bird is, say, looking for some grains, and some predator may come, and a cat may come and pounce on that bird. They have a risk of life at every moment. We humans don't have that level of risk. And yet, we humans, although we do not live under that level of danger as the animals, we suffer from more anxiety than animals. There are so many variety of anxiety disorders. The day before yesterday, I gave a talk on the anxiety epidemic. How there is so much anxiety in the world today. Scientists are calling it an epidemic. And animals have to work so hard for their needs, but animals never get depressed. No animal goes to psychiatrist to take an antidepressant treatment. No animal gets addicted to anything undesirable. A fish may be caught by a bait, a mouse may be caught by cheese in a mouse trap, but they have excuses. The bait looks like food, the cheese looks like food for a mouse, and they don't know in advance it's a trap. A cigarette does not look like food to anyone. And who doesn't know that cigarette smoking is injurious to health? But still, we humans smoke. So, what is happening here is, animals never suffer from addiction. And most graphically, animals never commit suicide. Animals may pine away. If a very faithful dog is there and the master dies, then the animal may also feel great, there is love over there, the capacity for love is there, and because of that loss of that love, then the animal may pine away and may die. Or sometimes some sheep, one sheep walks off a mountain cliff, other sheep will also walk off the mountain cliff. But that is more of a herd mentality. That is just because of lack of intelligence. That sheep jumping going off a mountain cliff, it is not caused by frustration with life because of which they want to end life. Now, animals in slaughterhouses, they live in such terrible conditions, horrible. Sometimes if there are hens, there are little thousands of hens packed in a small place, and all the hens peck each other. So they live in great torture, in torturous conditions. But even then, no animal ends its life on its own. But we humans have the dubious distinction of being the only species that commits suicide. And not only commit suicide, but it's in phenomenal numbers. Alarming, called WHO statistics. 1 million people commit suicide every year. That is one suicide every 40 seconds. That means since we started this class, almost 70-80 people have committed suicide. It's horrible. So why is this? So again, it brings us back to the same point. That we humans, because our consciousness is developed, we have the capacity to experience more pleasure than what the body can offer. And because of this developed conscience, it works both ways. We can experience more pleasure and we can experience more pain. So when we become frustrated, it is not just, say, you know, if a boy and a girl have an affair and then they break things. Then it is not just that breakage, is not just a frustration of the biological drive to mate. It is a frustration of the human heart's longing for love. And that causes enormous pain. So we humans, because of our developed consciousness, have the capacity to experience greater pleasure. And that capacity is meant to be directed towards raising our spiritual consciousness. By which we will experience eternal happiness by connecting with Krishna. By becoming self-realized and by becoming God-realized. But if we don't do that, then we seek pleasure at the material level. And then we experience more suffering than what the animals experience. And that's why we end up committing suicide. Now, animals also can have frustration in their relationship. You know, say, there is a dog and that dog has a she-dog. And then some bigger dog comes and grabs that she-dog away. This dog will be frustrated. But the dog doesn't commit suicide because of that. We humans do that because we seek more from the body and from the world than what the body and the world can give. We seek more pleasure and thus we open ourselves to more misery. So, but when we redirect this towards the spiritual direction, then we can experience far greater happiness than what anyone else can experience, any other species can experience. Now, I'll conclude with, I talked about what psychologists say, the four differences between humans and animals. Self-observation, self-evaluation, self-visualization and self-correction. And these faculties are there and they can be applied in material life also. But these abilities that we have, they are best applied in spiritual life. Self-observation means we try to understand who I really am. And at one level is I understand I am the soul. But at another level, I also observe how am I living. Am I living spiritually? Am I living materialistically? So that's self-observation. And then we can have self-correction. Scripture says I should be living like this, I am living like this. I self-evaluate. There's a difference. I need to change myself. And then self-visualization. I can improve. I can become a more serious devotee. I can become more purely devoted to Krishna. And we can have role models from whom we take inspiration. That's self-visualization. And then there is ultimately self-correction. We can actually rise to a spiritual level of consciousness. And there, our longing for happiness will be fulfilled. Eternally, completely and perfectly fulfilled. And that is the purpose for which the whole creation is made. And the Supreme Lord, after he created the human being, he was satisfied because now through the human form, he had provided the souls the opportunity to attain eternal happiness. And we all have that opportunity by Krishna's mercy, Vaishnava Prabhupada's mercy, by the Vaishnava's mercy, to practice Krishna consciousness and attain the complete fulfillment of our own longing for happiness and fulfill the purpose for which existence is manifested by the Supreme Lord, as is being described in these verses. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about the difference between, the broad overview of the class was the difference between humans and animals, as is understood by science, as is understood in the Abrahamic worldview, the Christian worldview broadly, and as is understood in the Bhagavatam worldview. So in the Christian worldview, it was actually the Greco-Christian worldview, because Christianity itself did not have much philosophy. So the idea was that humans have a special kind of soul. And the scientific worldview rejected this as just human ego. And it sort of brought up equality in all the species by despiritualizing all the species. Whereas the Bhagavatam brings about equality in all the species by re-spiritualizing all the species, by revealing that the same kind of soul is there in all bodies. And the difference between the human and the non-humans is dharma. But that dharma is not just doing some religious rituals. It is the metaphysical search for the ultimate purpose of life. What is there beyond? And humans, with their advanced intelligence, can do various activities which animals can't do. But the purposes remain the same. The purposes remain eating, sleeping, mating, defending. We discussed how science is largely motivated by that, technology especially. And then we discussed about how psychology says that there is some difference between humans and animals. Self-observation, self-evaluation, self-visualization, self-correction. But they say that these are just because our brain has more information processing capacity. So the Bhagavatam explains that the soul's covering is the least in the human form. Although the same souls are there in all species, the soul's covering is the least. And that's why the soul can fulfill its natural longing for happiness by perceiving spiritual reality and then by attaining the supreme spiritual reality, Krishna. So we humans suffer more than the animals in many ways because our consciousness is so developed that we can't be satisfied with the happiness that the body offers. And when we try to seek more from the body than what the body gives, then we end up getting more suffering. So that suffering can be both in terms of eating, sleeping, waiting, defending itself, we suffer. But also our overall life, you know, we suffer from depression, we suffer from anxiety, we suffer from addictions, we suffer from suicidal urges. All this is because we have the capacity for greater pleasure. And because of that developed consciousness, we also have the capacity for experiencing greater pain. And so the human form is the longing for happiness and the capacity for seeking higher happiness. That is then the human form that can be fulfilled when we pursue the spiritual path and realize ourselves and realize our relationship with Krishna. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions? Yes, Madam.
Please correct me. From Bhagavatam we understand that the gross comes from the subtle. The gross body is a product of the subtle body. That means the animal's subtle body is different from the human subtle body. That means the subtle body has evolved, has changed. So with the same soul, when it goes from an animal to a human, there is evolution in a different form.
There is evolution.
Yeah, the subtle body has evolved into a different subtle body in the human form. Because the soul is the same. The Bhagavatam again says the soul is identical. That means what is evolving is matter, the subtle body. So, to criticize Darwin completely would not be correct. Darwin doesn't have the concept of a subtle body. Bhagavatam also says matter is evolving. How do you react?
Okay. So, when the soul moves from the animal to the human body, it is a subtle body that develops. And subtle body is matter. So, in that sense, matter is evolving. So, is it right to correct Darwin, to criticize Darwin entirely? He doesn't have the specific concept of how matter is evolving. But the principle that matter is evolving, is that wrong, according to Bhagavatam? No. Now, Prabhupada would use the word spiritual evolution. But then, what he is talking about is actually it is the evolution of the soul's consciousness as is manifested in the material world. And that manifestation is through matter. So, we can call it spiritual evolution in a generic sense. In the sense that, okay, the answer is a little technical. There's two concepts you don't understand. There's chit and there is chitta. Sat, chit, ananda. Chit is consciousness. The faculty for consciousness that the soul has. That is the innate characteristic of the soul. Chitta is the embodied consciousness of the soul. When the soul's consciousness is rooted through the body, that is called as chitta. And interestingly, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna in 13.7 states that consciousness is a product of matter. Now, Prabhupada said life comes from life. But Krishna says, vikaramcha gunamcha eva विद्धि प्रकृति संभव इसे इच्छा द्वेष सुखम दुखम संघात चेतनाधुति विकारांश गुणांश विद्धि प्रकृति संभव सो ही सेज दैट दैट इच्छा डिजायर एवर्जन द्वेष सुख दुख हैप्पीनेस स्ट्रेस एंड चेतना consciousness. These are transformations of kshetra. They are transformations of the body. Now, if consciousness is coming from the soul, why is it said that chetana is a transformation of the body? The two different things are being talked about over here. Chit, the consciousness comes from the soul. But the embodied consciousness, chitta, that is rooted through the subtle body. So, a simple example to illustrate this. Somebody goes to watch a movie. Then that person has the capacity to look left, look right, look at the ceiling, look at the floor. But that person gets glued to the movie. Then that consciousness is caught in the whatever is being depicted in the movie. Or say if it's not a movie, it's a cricket match being played somewhere. Then that person's consciousness is transported through the screen to wherever the cricket match is being played. So now the consciousness transported through the television screen, that is chitta. And the consciousness that is able to perceive the world around, that is chit. So now, for a person watching a cricket match, that person can anytime turn off the cricket match and look around. But for the soul, that is not possible. When the soul is attached to the body, at that time, the soul's consciousness is locked into the body. So right now, we can perceive only through the body. So we don't have any access to chit. We have access only to chit. Chitta is our embodied consciousness. So, now, when the soul moves from an animal species to human species, the pathway through the which the consciousness is getting rooted, that is going to change. The animals provide an animal body provides a particular pathway. The human body provides a particular pathway. Now, the interesting thing is that actually the soul moves with the subtle body. When a living being dies, the gross body is left behind. The soul and the subtle body go over. So then, if an elephant is becoming a human being, now the soul and the subtle body are essentially the same. The same unit has moved from here to here, from the animal body to human body. So how is it that the desires change? Now, an elephant is attracted to elephant food. We humans, even a small infant, is not attracted to elephant food. It's attracted to human food. That because when the soul transmigrates, it is not just a physical relocation. It is also a psychological redirection. The subtle body's desires also change. So in that sense, the subtle body evolves. So matter is evolving. And to reject the evolution of matter is not correct. But to extrapolate from that there is no God, there is no soul, which are the atheistic implications to which the theory of evolution is applied, those atheistic implications we definitely reject. Okay.
Thank you. Now yes. I have a question.
Okay.
How much role is we hear of the hellish planets where somebody was conditioned?
Yeah.
Can you relate that into your conversation? How much does that is not as subtle body conditioned for you sent to the hellish planets?
Okay. Yeah. So the question is that when we are say the soul goes from one species to another, often sometimes the soul goes in between to a hellish body, and how does the conditioning or reconditioning of the soul from one body to another happen during the hellish during stay in hellish planets? The Garuda Puran talks quite a bit about this. There is there are three different concepts I'll talk about. First is that there is something which is called the punishment body. So the body which we have, there is pleasure as well as pain in it. But and the soul has done a lot of sinful activities. And the reactions, as I mentioned yesterday, can come in three ways. There soul may do bad karma in human body, some reaction may come in a human form. Some reaction may come in an animal form, and some reaction may come in a hellish body, in a hellish planet. So now in the hellish planet, there is a punishment body. What the punishment body means is that The body feels pain, but the body does not break down. Now, in this world, we have a body. Its capacity to experience pain is limited. And when the pain becomes too much, the body defends itself by becoming unconscious. That's why if a person gets a heavy blow on the head, then the person falls unconscious. That's the body's defense mechanism. And similarly, that fainting can also be an emotional defense mechanism. If somebody hears a terrible news, the person cannot bear the shock, so the body defends itself by switching off. People faint at that time. So, the human body has a limited capacity to experience pain. Either it switches off, becomes unconscious, or it breaks down, it gets destroyed, and the soul has to leave the body. But in hell, whatever punishments are there in hell, you know, they are not inflicted on the soul. The soul is spiritual, and nothing material can affect the soul. So there is a body which is given those punishments. But that body is such that even after being subjected to the punishments, the soul feels the pain, but the body doesn't break down and the body doesn't switch off. So in that sense, that is a system that is arranged for giving the soul corrective lessons. And specifically how, depending on where a soul is supposed to go, with which species a soul is supposed to go, accordingly, the soul is given conditioning accordingly. So now, generally speaking, it is, in the sixth canto, in the Yamaraj, in the Avadhana Pastime, it said that Yamaraj's jurisdiction is on human beings. Animals, non-human beings, they don't commit sin. They don't have the free will only to commit sin. So they are not in his jurisdiction. So, the humans, when they do sinful activity, and when the soul is going to devolve downwards, at that time, some of the correction that is done through the punishment body in hell or elsewhere, that will play a role. But when the soul is evolving upwards, at that time, there is no such intervention. So the downward evolution of the soul, Prabhupada gives the example, one place that, how can a human who finds stool abominable, how can a human being become a hog who loves stool? So he says that the soul who has done sinful activities and is supposed to go into a hog's body next life, that soul is put in a place where it's like a dirty swampy river and there is no food available except stool. And sheer the need for survival, because there's nothing else to eat, so that person starts eating it. Third canto in Kapila's teachings, it is said that narkastopi dehane purusham tejetichasi. So it says that actually the nature of the soul is whatever one starts doing repeatedly, gradually one gets enjoyment in that. And not only the enjoyment, one gets addicted to that. Like sometimes when people say drink for the first time or smoke for the first time, they get either a coughing fit or they feel very uncomfortable. But if they just keep doing it, they become hooked to that. So like that, the soul gets reconditioned that way to eating hog's food. So yes, the hellish reconditioning in hellish conditions will play a role when the soul is evolving downwards from the human species downwards. But that won't play a role when the soul is evolving upwards from the lower species to the upper species. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Okay. Yes, we'll come to you.
Non-human species. So, as a consequence of that, slaughterhouses and everything became okay and everybody is eating like that. And now there is a conscience movement that is going on, which is primarily expressed in this veganism, culture of veganism, and they're accepting it. Their conscience has awoken and they can see this is wrong and this is unjust. So, my question is, there are philosophers and thinkers who are saying that religious systems are dogmatic and the only purpose religion serves is morality and morals. And you can see these systems are so crooked
that they have been inflicting all this slavery and, you know, animal abuse and everything. So there's Peter Singer, there's Sam Harris, there are these philosophers who are
aggressive atheists.
Yes,
very so aggressive atheists, yeah.
So they are trying to build moral codes and codex to run a human society which is free of religion, there's no need of God, but we will have our value systems and morals. So I'd like to hear from you what you think is the implications of that.
Yeah. So nowadays there are atheists who say that religion is meant to provide morality, but religions themselves are corrupt and they are not fulfilling the purpose of providing morality, and we can evolve alternative systems of morality. And say, for example, even without any religion, the vegan movement is developing, wherein there is, because of the call of conscience, people want to abstain from killing animals. So can the need for morality be served without any religion, without God? This is a major philosophical debate in today's world. I'll just speak three quick points. First is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Chaitanya Shikshamrit talks about four categories of people. He says there are atheistic immoral, there are atheistic moral, there are theistic immoral, and there are theistic moral. So, you can imagine four boxes. So, theism, atheism, morality, immorality. So, theistic moral, atheistic moral, then theistic immoral and atheistic immoral. There are these four kinds of people. So, he also, based on his observation, acknowledges that theism does not necessarily equate with morality. Now, many people, they may just think that they are theistic. So, in fact, says that these Ishwarvadi anaitik, these theistic immoralists, they often end up as the worst anti-preachers for religion. Because by their behavior, they alienate people. The atheists, they are openly atheistic. These people, the theistic immoral, theistic and immoral, they often alienate people. Because other people think that these are religious, but see, religious people are like this. And therefore people get alienated. So, he also recognizes that what society needs and what is recommended is theistic morals. Of course, he talks about one more category is how devotees may transcend morality for the sake of Krishna. Like the gopis leave their homes and families when Krishna calls. But that is completely beyond this. That's like, we have to talk about moral and immoral. What he's talking about is transmoral, higher morality. Let's not go into that. But this classification is there in Bhaktivinoda Thakur also. And he says that what Vaishnava should be as practicing should be theistic moralists. No, we should not use our theism as a license for becoming immoral. Because I'm chanting Hare Krishna, everything goes. But it doesn't work like that. So in our history, in the history of our movement, it happened. Everybody thought we are distributing books. So by hook or crook, distribute books. And that person will get book. But sometimes devotees would speak lies about what the books contain, would cheat people, and that led to a lot of anti-preaching. So we can't do that. We have to be moral also. And morality, of course, is a characteristic of goodness. So now, this is the one perspective. Second perspective would be that, as I said, morality is a product of goodness. And goodness itself is not necessarily theistic in terms of belief in God. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 18th chapter, when Krishna talks about the qualities of a Brahmana, he says that Shamo Damastapah Shaucham Shantir Arjamayamacha Jnanam Vijnanam Astikyam Brahma Karma Sabhava. So there is the Astikya. But that Astikya, in the Vedic context, doesn't mean belief in God. It means belief in Vedas. And belief in Vedas generically means belief that there are some higher powers with which we need to harmonize ourselves. So a person can be a Brahmana without necessarily, Brahman in the sense of being in goodness, without necessarily having belief in God. So, it is true that just as there can be, the Bhagavatam talks about bhakti in goodness, bhakti in passion, bhakti in ignorance. So just as there can be bhakti in goodness, passion, ignorance, there can also be atheism in goodness, passion, ignorance. Atheism itself is a worldview that is founded in ignorance. It's fundamental ignorance of the ultimate reality. But still, atheists, as far as their psychological disposition is concerned, as far as their swabhav is concerned, it's not necessary that all atheists may be tamasic. There can be people who are sattvic and they have chosen atheism because they have such bad experiences with religion. And no, it is true that many religious people have been very arrogant. And their arrogance has alienated many people. So there are thoughtful people who will turn towards atheism because they are put off, because they don't get answers to their questions in religion, or because religious people seem very hypocritical, very arrogant and things like that. So the point is, even in our philosophy, it's possible that people can be moral and still be atheistic. Because mode of goodness can be cultivated without necessarily having a direct spiritual person, spiritual aspect to one's life. However, we also know that mode of goodness is also a cause of bondage. So, in that sense, it's not an ultimate solution. So, now, the second point, first point I talked about is that our philosophy accommodates this possibility that there can be morality, at least in terms of moral conduct, without necessarily there being devotion to God or theism. Secondly, from a philosophical perspective, can there be a morality without an absolute source of morality? That means, on what basis do I decide what is right and what is wrong? Now, we all humans have a moral sense, in the sense that we all accept that there is something which is right, there is the principle of right and wrong. But what is right and what is wrong, that different cultures have different ideas. So, how do we decide what is right and what is wrong? If there is no absolute source of morality, on what basis will we decide that? Will it be decided based on just the current culture? That if the culture changes, then will moral conceptions also change? If moral conceptions change like that, then what is the foundation for that? Is it just majority opinion? If it's majority opinion, then according to majority opinion, you know, Hitler's killing of the Jews in the Holocaust was fine. That was Hitler's morality. So if we don't have an absolute source of morality, who will decide what is moral? If it is just going to be by democracy, then it can be misleading. And we don't have to go to distant history. Recent history has that examples. Holocaust, and there are other examples also of that. So we cannot really have morality without an absolute source of morality. We may certainly, there are in morality also, there are certain decisions which are relatively easier to make. Okay, to kill animal, not to kill animals. And for us it is, if a person is observing, that is easy to make. But there are many lines which are set in situations where what is right and what is wrong is not so easy to decide. So that is a philosophical argument which is often used to talk about how you cannot have morality without some basis for morality. In terms of how, on what framework do we decide what is right and what is wrong. But more importantly, we can question the assumption of the atheist itself, that religion is a system meant for promoting morality. We don't agree with that. Our purpose is, the religion is meant to facilitate the development of spiritual consciousness. Religion is meant to develop self-realization. And this is another fundamental difference between the Abrahamic religions and the Vedic yoga-based traditions. Because in the Abrahamic religions, there is no territory or there is no pathway charted for the development of Indian human consciousness. Now it says you begin with faith in Jesus, you end with faith in Jesus. That's all. There is no pathway given for developing your consciousness. Yes, there can be people who by practicing Christianity, they may become better. There are Christians who may be addicts and they accept Jesus and they give up addiction. That transformation is possible. But what I'm talking about is a pathway given for the transformation. A systematic analysis of the states of consciousness and how consciousness develops. So that is not talked about. So our so the Vedic understanding is that that morality is a fringe benefit of religion. In one sense, there is paradharma and there is aparadharma. So aparadharma is important, but aparadharma is not the primary purpose of religion. Without religion, or without religions giving us the ultimate purpose of life, pointing us towards the ultimate purpose of life, we may live morally according to our popularly accepted concept of morality. But for what purpose are we living? What is the purpose of our life? So the ultimate purpose, there will be no ultimate purpose left to life. So as one European philosopher, Alfred White, he said, who are we but just electrons moving around aimlessly and endlessly? That's what we are ultimately. So we may say that we will be moral in our life, but both morality and life itself become pointless unless there is God. So the purpose of religion is not to just get people to adhere to certain codes of morality, although that is one purpose which is there. And although in the Abrahamic religion, that is what is primarily emphasized. But in the Vedic path, yes, morality is there, but that is not the primary purpose. The primary purpose is spiritual inquiry and development of spiritual consciousness. Well, that's why actually if Krishna consciousness can be presented in a non-sectarian way to the mainstream world, then it is a very, very superior alternative to the conceptions of religion that are present in the world today. Unfortunately, even in our movement, sometimes our presentation of Krishna consciousness becomes very cultish. And because of that, people get alienated. But we present the broad principles of Bhakti Yoga, and then, then we see that the people think there are only these two alternatives, theism and atheism. And by theism, they have the conception of the Abrahamic religions. But then, what the Bhagavatam offers us is something which goes beyond this dichotomy entirely. Because it doesn't, because theism and atheism both are founded on the material conception of life. The Bhagavatam challenges that conception by offering a spiritual conception of life. And that's why the Bhagavatam worldview needs to be propagated, and not propagated aggressively, but propagated sensitively and intelligently. And then people who are seeking to atheism, not because they are defiantly against God, but because they are fed up with religion, those people will be given a better alternative. Okay? It's already 9 o'clock. Today evening also we will have a session. You want to make an announcement? So those of you who have questions, in future classes, raise those questions in the late future classes. Today evening, there will be a class where we will have only question answers. That will be where?
In the temple theater.
In the temple theater. So if any questions are unanswered, you can ask at that time. Thank you very much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Tai Gaur Premanandi.